The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly Guest Dharma series.
So it's my great pleasure tonight to introduce my dear Dharma teacher, Mia O. Sharon, and I've known Mia O. for a long time, but I have cringed because she's got so many accomplishments. She's an ordained priest and a senior practitioner in the Soto Zen Buddhist tradition. And currently she's affiliated with the Hokyoji Zen practice community under the guidance of Reverend Dokai Jorgensen. And that's just at the very, very, very bottom of Minnesota. She's been practicing in the Soto Zen and Vipassana traditions for 37 years now. Looks so young. And Yellow also has an extensive background in the performing arts, and she's trained in a number of body-mind practices. She's the guiding teacher for Dharma Dance Sangha in Minneapolis, and she said she'd leave a little bit of information about that downstairs on the board. And she also works at the University of Minnesota Medical Center as an interfaith chaplain. And in November, Mia O is going to receive Dharma transmission, and this is something she's been working for a long time. It's an intimate Zen ritual. It takes place over a week of ceremonies, and in that her teacher acknowledges her accomplishments and that she's fully ordained and can teach on her own. So it really is a very, very significant accomplishment in Zen to receive Dharma transmission. And tonight we're going to have a different kind of transmission, a wonderful transmission about care for the heart in difficult times. And I know this is something that Mia O herself has really practiced with a lot and has a lot of wisdom to impart. So thank you so much for being here, Mia O, and I look forward to your talk. And thank you all for coming.
Do you guys want to come over this way? I don't want to miss you. And I can feel I'm missing you already. Thank you. Yeah, that's better. So I want to thank Patrice, who spent most of the day at Stillwater Prison leading a, was it a retreat?
Or yeah, it was just the regular group we have.
A group, leading a group, which is a really incredible practice, and it's hard to know who benefits most. Yeah, she benefits most. I understand that. Thank you for that. I was thinking, while I was not thinking, while we were meditating, about the circles of connections. There's so many circles of me being here. Mark and I were in the first community Dharma leader training program at Spirit Rock. And because of that, one of the times we were there, Shota Harada Roshi happened to be there giving a talk. And I started out in the Zen tradition in 1975. With Katagiri Roshi, who started the Minnesota Zen Meditation Center. I thought I'd just kind of give you a little story. And then else you kind of know where I sprouted from. And then I started also practicing Vipassana, which was extremely helpful to me. So Mark and I were there, and this Japanese teacher happened to be there on a Monday night at Spirit Rock and gave a talk. And I sat in the front row, and I couldn't understand a word it said because it was in Japanese. But they had a translator, and I just cried for the whole thing. And afterwards, some of my compatriots said, "How come you didn't ordain us as Zen priest?" And I went, "Oh, can you imagine me as a Zen priest? That's just ridiculous." And lo and behold, 2 years later, through various causes and conditions, I did do that. I returned to Katagiri Roshi's lineage. So Mark and I have shared a lot, and we often, we also share now going to Northfield to teach in that community. So there's a lot of interlinking circles. And Steve and Kamala, you know, yeah, they're very dear, dear teachers for me. And so I went backwards. I started with Zen, and then I studied Vipassana, and I learned how to meditate. Then I went back to Zen. You can ask my husband, right? I couldn't sit still, so I studied Vipassana. It really, really, really helped me understand Zen a lot. So tonight, I want to talk, I want to tell some stories. So in the Zen tradition, they're not that swift about instructions for meditation. Like Katagiri Roshi used to say, just jump into the big ocean. And I'd be like, okay, what does that mean? but they're very, and they do these teaching stories. These teaching stories that kind of sound wacky. You know, they just like don't make any sense at all. But actually they do. They do. So I want to talk a little bit from these stories. And right now, boy, are we in the middle of stories. I was at the Y earlier today, and they have a TV, you know, with no sound, and they just say what they're saying. It's kind of funny. And so, you know, the election, it's CNN, I think, so luckily I can't hear it, but, woo, you know, all those guys are up there. So, there's a lot of pressures in our world. I think there's always a lot of pressures in our world, but right now they're kind of more obvious. So we have the presidential election, we have the, you know, the marriage amendment, shall we obstruct same-sex marriage or not, who gets to vote or not, and then there's escalating violence in Syria, which is terrifying. So where do peace and understanding live? Obviously, we haven't figured it out yet. And which worldview will we embrace? Now, I'm preaching to the choir here, but, you know, will it be a narrow and self-centered worldview, or will it be collaborative and connecting? And it seems like each view is threatening the other, which seems insane to me, but that's the way it seems. So this fear generated by these causes cause suffering. That fear causes suffering. And how do we dialogue with these issues and these views in a way that's life-giving and alive? Because we're always going to have all these problems. So how do we dialogue with them? It's really hard, challenging. So these issues and the processes around them present us with a big loaded koan. You know that word, koan? Yeah. So a koan is a Zen story, like I was saying, that is this dialogue between two practitioners, okay? Or a teacher and her disciple. So in ordinary thinking, these dialogues don't make any sense, really. But there's two things that are happening in these dialogues. So the first one is there's deep connection and intimacy between the two characters. So we can't forget that, because otherwise it seems like what they're doing is really nuts, like hitting each other and yelling and stuff like that. So this deep intimacy is based on a profound intention to wake up, help each other wake up. So, you know, sometimes our friends, our dear friends who practice with us say, Myo-o, your mind is messed up. You know? They don't say, oh, that's all right. That's that slapping. Right? That's good. That's a big help. Because I don't really want to go to sleep. I do go to sleep, but I don't want to go to sleep. And then the second one is, this is important, these characters, these two characters, they're dancing across a threshold between relative and absolute reality. They're dancing. They're not holding to either side. They're dancing. They're going back and forth through the gate, and they're egging each other on. And they're reminding each other not to get stuck in one side or the other, in the relative view or the absolute view. Not to get stuck. To be stuck in either view does not develop wisdom or compassion. Right? Right? Well, let's look at some stories and see if it's true. So I'm going to tell you about this family. Okay, so there is this family in China in the 8th century, and it's called the Pang family, P-A-N-G, Pang. Okay, so there's a dad, and the dad is called Layman Pang. And he was born as Pang Yun around 740 CE in Xi'an province in China, wherever that is. I don't know where that is. His name means lofty interior, and his nickname, Dao Xuan, means way mystery. He died on August 3rd, 808. Okay, so at that time in the 8th and 9th century in China, there was this great flowering of Chan, or Zen, or meditation practice. And so Layman Pang met all these incredible teachers. His father was the boss of one of these provinces, and he lived there, and he married, and he had a son and a daughter. And his daughter, he was very, very close to his daughter was named Ling Xiao, which means spirit shining. There's lots of stories about him and his daughter. So when he turned middle-aged, he gave his house away to be used as a temple. And he sank his money and his possessions in the river, which blew people's minds. They still talk about it. That's how we know. And also, that time in China was a very difficult time. Just like now, it's a very difficult time. People were hungry. But he gave everything away because he didn't want people to be confused by their possessions, just like now. He didn't want to hurt anyone's chance of entering the way. So he put his possessions in the river as a compassionate action. It kind of sounds like something Rumi would do. You know? So his son became a farmer and supported Mrs. Pang. And Layman Pang and Ling Zhao wandered around and sold bamboo kitchen implements. So in 785, he traveled. So this is what you did if you were a practitioner in China. You put on your straw sandals and you walked around and you found teachers. You found teachers. So our teachers fly here. You know, like they come and they lead retreats, but you would walk around. Okay, so he went to, and he found Master Shitu, who was a very, very famous Zen teacher. He wrote the Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage, which is a total bliss poem, which if I start getting into it, we'll never get out of here tonight. But his name, Shitu, means cloud, cliff, cloudy light. There's a lot of poetry in Chinese Zen. So Layman Pang was enlightened by Shitu immediately. He was enlightened by him immediately. So they had one of these dialogues. Where did you come from? That I'm talking about. I'm dying to have one of those. You know, you go to your teacher, you bow, you ask a question, he yells, or he throws something, or he coughs, or something, and then, poof, that's it. You got it. You're enlightened. Anyway, he had one of those conversations with Shitu. He stayed with him for a year, and then he went to another incredible teacher, Mao Tzu, Ma Tzu, Master Ma, super famous Zen teacher who had hundreds of disciples. And with Master Ma, Layman Pong experienced great, complete, unsurpassed enlightenment. And he stayed there for 2 years and received permission to teach from Ma Tzu. Now, then he went around and he met with monks. Now, this is what monks like to do when they hang out with each other. They want to see whose realization was the deepest. So they kind of have these contests. Have you ever seen the Tibetans with their beads and when they're practicing arguing? You know, and they I don't know what they're saying, but they, and then he throws his bead and, you know, they try to catch each other out. So it's kind of like that. I wrote, that's how they had fun and helped each other wake up. So that was their idea of fun. Then he went back to his hometown and lived in a cave with his daughter. So there's a story that when Layman Pong was ready to die, he got all ready, he took a bath, and he was going to sit on his cushion and die sitting up. That was a tradition, to die sitting. His daughter said, Father, come and look! The eclipse is happening! So he went to the door of the cave and he looked. And then his daughter jumped on his cushion and died first. So he and his daughter had this friendly ongoing competition, kind of loving Dharma competition going through their whole lives. So she won, which she thought was great. Then a week later he died. Do you see how these stories are really wacky? So I like Layman Pong. He defies the category, just like us. He had no ambition. He was a lay practitioner who lived like a monk, and yet he declined to become a monk. He didn't give lectures or train disciples. So I'm thinking, like, I'm dressed like a monk, but I live with my husband, and I have a house, and I have a daughter. So what am I? I don't know. Here I am. Here we are, practicing together. So I want to tell you some stories, but I want to engage you as well. So in the middle, I'm going to ask you stuff, and I hope you'll just respond. So what's important about these stories is not the content exactly, but the play between the relative and the absolute reality. Learning how to play like this can guide us in these dialogues that we're constantly engaged in our lives. So before I tell this first story, so the stories are all about Layman Pong and his daughter, okay? Before I tell it, I want to invite you to play a game, but you need to turn to somebody near you for this to work. So everybody has a partner. Does everybody have a partner? I don't know. You can improvise. I don't know if that'll work. So you know that game? So you have to be facing each other. And somebody has their hands like this, and someone has their hands like this, and you're going to try to, you know, see if you can, and then don't let yourself get grabbed, okay?
Thank you.
The layman was sitting in his thatched cottage one day. Difficult, he suddenly exclaimed, like trying to scatter 10 measures of sesame seed all over a tree. Easy, 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 returned Mrs. Penn, just like touching your feet to the ground when you get out of bed. Neither difficult nor easy, said Ling Zhao, on the 100 grass tips, the patriarch's meaning. You got it? Well, that's good. I was good. Okay, so let's just go over this. So, Layman Pong is yelling, difficult, like trying to scatter 10 measures of sesame seed all over a tree. So can you imagine, so you have a bunch of sesame seed, you're trying to get it to stick to the tree. That's pretty hard. It doesn't stay. So, have you ever had that experience? Not necessarily with sesame seeds, but trying to get something to, and it's not like when you're trying to concentrate when you're meditating and your mind is going, right? And so on one level, that's what this is about. It's a technical freak out. You know, he's just naming. Oh my God, this morning my meditation sucks. I can't do anything. Now, have anybody here ever had that experience? And me too. So, our concentration is nowhere sometimes. We don't know what we're doing, and we get frustrated, and we have self-abnegation and doubt. We can't do it. Or something. Of course, the joke is that each of the mind states that arises is the gate. It's not the problem, it's the gate. So even the aversive mind state is the gate, right? To freedom. It's not something bad, it's not that we clumped. So that's one side. And the other side is, easy, easy, like touching your feet to the floor when you get out of bed in the morning. So one side, that's the other side, but both of these sides are in relative reality. They're in duality. Difficult, easy. Right? One of the 8 worldly winds, difficult, easy. They're in relative reality. So the world of story, of good, bad, right, wrong, coming and going, easy and difficult. They presume a reality that's embedded in subject and object, not in flow and release and mutuality, mutual reflection. Is that okay? Does that make sense? Okay. So Layman Pong's daughter is playing in absolute reality in the ocean from which the stories appear and disappear. She teaches not holding on to either side, not difficult, not easy, and gives us a visual metaphor of the movement of the grass tips, which we know on the prairie in China, right? The grass tips, like the prairie ocean, shifting and ungraspable. So I notice where I suffer is when my mind does this. The minute it just thinks about going, and I'm already, I'm suffering. I remember Shinzen Young, who was one of our teachers a long time ago. He said one time, but I never forgot this, he said, at this point in his practice, he doesn't have any small annoyances. Everything is cataclysmic, no matter what it is. And I was like, great, you know, this is what I signed up for. But now I understand. It's like the minute I miss, I really the suffering is huge. It's not, because that sort of filter of like, oh, it's no big deal, that doesn't work. It's not there. It's gone. So, I can understand. So she's the youngest one in the koan, and she gives the freshest view. Okay, so is that okay? So that's one story. Okay, here's another story. One day, Chan Master Tan Xia Chan came to visit the layman. This is his buddy. Okay. As soon as he reached the gate, he saw layman's daughter, Ling Chao, carrying a basket of greens. "Is the layman here?" asked Tan Xia. Ling Chao put down the basket of greens, politely folded her arms, one on top of the other, and stood still. "Is the layman here?" asked Tan Xia again. Ling Chao picked up the basket and walked away. Tan Xia then departed. When the layman returned a little later, Ling Chao told him of the conversation. "Is Tan Xia here?" asked the layman. "He's gone," replied Ling Chao. "Red earth painted with milk," remarked the layman. Okay? Okay. These aren't kind of intellectual. They're more like performance art. You have to think of it like performance art, then it's easier. So Tan Xia was a really close brother, Dharma brother, of Layman Pom. So they both were enlightened by Shi Tu. You know, that's a very profound thing to share. So this is a dance. Now, why are we talking about this? We're talking about this because this is the kind of dance and dialogue that we're doing all day long, or that we could be doing all day long. So this is illuminating what we're doing all day long, but we might not remember that we are. So that's why we're diving into this story. Okay? Is that okay? Can we keep going? Okay. So, first of all, Tan Xia came to the gate. So in the world of Zen koans, that gate is significant, right? It's the gate. This is the place where we move into and out of absolute reality. So he came to the gate, and he met Ling Chao. He asked, you know, "Is your dad home?" He asked this question from relative reality, our ordinary reality of coming and going, this and that, subject and object. So that's where he was at. However, Ling Chao answered him from the other side of the gate with a silent, respectful movement that embodied absolute reality. She was opening the gate to him to join her there or to play with that movement. She was inviting him, but he didn't get it. He missed it. Okay? He missed it. He just asked, "Is your father home?" Hello? You know, again. And she just walked away without answering. So her walking away was saying, "You blew it, buddy." Of course, she knew him really well also. I'm not wasting my time with this. Sometimes we do that. We actually do that, don't we, sometimes? It's just bullshit what's happening. And we don't engage it. Occasionally. So we're just like her. Uh-uh. That's not appropriate now. You missed it. But she's not rude. She doesn't yell at him or call him names. She just leaves the scene. Okay. Then Layman comes home and he asks his daughter, from the absolute point of view, "Is Tan Xia here?" So that's a trick. You know, there's no here there. There's no there here. It's all here. How could he not be here? So he's asking from there. But she, not sitting stuck in absolute reality, answers, he's gone. So she goes back to the other side. So they're playing. Then he says something that basically means this is all nonsense, which is red earth painted with milk. I mean, whatever. This is silliness. So these are like your best buddies that you do contact improvisation with, and you've been doing it for years. Okay, so they're like your best buddies, or they're your best buddies in your study group, and you know each other's shit, you know, and you've been studying for years. Okay, and their minds are very open and clear. This is the way they check each other and help each other maintain their practice. So that's why I said it's like performance art. They're playing. They're playing. But they're playing to sharpen the clarity of their mind in the big mind. That's how they're playing. And the responses are asked to be living right down to the marrow. You know what it's like when you have a dialogue and it's suddenly like really alive? It's really like, wow, something's happening. That's this. So this isn't so far away from ordinary life. Like, one time, there's a gas station near my house, and there was this Native American little lady, old lady, who worked there in the cash register. And I was, this is a long time ago, I was like practicing metta, like in secret. So I was always practicing metta for her. I didn't know her. You know, every time I went to get my gas, I just practiced metta. She had no idea I was doing that. And then this went on for a couple of years. And one time I went there to get gas. I gave her my money. And she said, my daughter's in the hospital. She's dying from hepatitis C. She doesn't know anything about me. Nothing. She doesn't even know my name. What happened? Space opened up. And luckily for both of us, I knew that was happening. The gate just went. And so I could be there in that. Haven't you ever had an experience like that? Sure. Sure you have. So that's all these stories are reminding us, you know, that we can play like this. So tell me a story in your life of a dialogue like this, like that.
I had a child who died of cancer, and the year after he died, I was working in nursing homes. I had five people in five different nursing homes tell me, you brought your little boy with you.
Whoa.
Yeah. They did not know me. And I had many people who were elderly tell me about their children who had died spontaneously, just like that. Because for some reason, they knew that my gate was open. They knew.
Anyone else have a story they want to tell? Oh, yes.
This was many years ago, first four-day silent retreat I ever went on. And the teacher was a woman from California, looked a little bit like one of the Beach Boys. And I was, right from the beginning, I had an aversion to the teacher. I didn't trust her. I didn't like her. It was all fear-based. I didn't know her at all, but this is what I determined. And, you know, we were into our first or second day, and she said, I want all the beginning. up, meet at one of the local lodges, and I just wanted to talk to you about how things are going. So I followed her down. I was one of the first ones to get to the little lodge. And she had some chairs arranged. And I'm sitting in one of the chairs, and it's just her and me and other students who were in. And I'm looking out the window like this at some of the other students. So she says to me, "So right now, are you sitting or are you waiting? Are you sitting or she, I'm sorry, are you waiting or are you sitting?" The other way around. So here we had come from the big room. We were practicing being present, sitting. And 2 minutes later, I'm not sitting, I'm waiting. I'm engaged with the fact that the other students haven't gotten here yet. When I had an opportunity during this whole retreat to get rid of that stuff. And that opened the gate for me. I thought she was the best teacher. And it was that moment that, you know, everything. So it was a very interesting experience. I like the idea of the gate, it certainly was.
Thank you. Is anybody else dying to tell a story? Okay, so now I'm going to tell a little bit different story. This isn't about Layman Pong. This is about a 17-year-old nun named Miaoshin. I love Miaoshin. Okay, so this nun's job was to run the guest house at the bottom of the mountain. At the top of the mountain was the monastery where the famous teacher taught and lived with the monks. But her job was to run the guest house. So one night, 17 monks came from somewhere. They were going to go see the great teacher. And they were arguing with each other about a very famous Zen story, which I'm going to tell you in a second. So this is a story in a story. So, you know, there was like a thin wall. She was on one side, and she could hear them arguing. So that story, the story they're arguing about, is a story about the wind and the flag. So one monk says, the wind is, so there's a flag blowing, right? One monk says, the wind is moving. The other monk says, the flag is moving. And then the sixth ancestor, who's an incredible teacher, famous teacher, says, the flag is not moving, the wind is not moving, your mind, you are moving your mind. So that's the story they were arguing about. That okay? Kind of in the movie. So she understood that these monks were missing the boat. They weren't getting it. And so her attendant told the monks that Miaoshin had said that they were blind donkeys, unable to even dream about the Buddha Dharma. So the monks actually were very respectful, and they came and they bowed and they offered incense and they asked her to help them. And what she did was she taught them through tricking them into the moment before anything moved. So like if you happen to be a dancer, this might make a lot of sense. So here's what she did. So they're all like, please help us. And she said, please, come closer. Okay, so there's the 17 monks. Please, come closer. But before they could move, she shouted, the wind is not moving. The flag is not moving. The mind is not moving. And they all were enlightened. Okay? And they didn't go see the teacher. They left. They got what they came for. They were caught in relative reality, and she set them up to experience directly what moves. They had a non-dualistic experience of what moves, a direct experience of absolute reality, which is life's continuous and all-pervading movement. So that's another story about this play of the relative and the absolute. the wisdom that generates compassion encompasses the whole of this kind of play. It's not ego-based play. It's a play that's coming from that scream that wants to understand from suffering, from our suffering. What? You know? From that place. That's where this play is. That's what this play is attending to. It's playful, but it's playful in that question. Okay? So how does this work in the koan of our election, of the marriage amendment, of the voter ID amendment, of the awful anti-Muslim video that the reaction to created incredible violence? So help me. How does it work? I'm really asking you. I'm really asking you. Yeah, maybe.
There's something about this election which allows me, which my practice allows me to experience as part of a very big historical movement that the players on this particular stage don't have a lot to say about. Mm. You know, the causes and conditions that brought us together. And I can rest there, and then I can't rest there. You know, there's still awful things that can happen. But I get that peace. I get that peace that helps me to understand that we're all in a struggle.
So anybody else? Yeah, please.
Well, all I see is that the gate is closed in all of those. Is that right? Did I get that? There's a duality in all of these things that you talk about.
Yeah.
Yeah, I am. I don't know the answer. It's not a quiz. I don't know. Yeah, Lynn.
I was just telling a little story, and I don't know. It's
going to
happen, right? But I went to the fair twice this year. I took my 87-year-old friend who could hardly walk. And in the seed art area, there was a cake with a heterosexual couple on it and a bunch of words of different names. And I'm looking at it, it's just like a yes, no. I couldn't quite figure out what the meaning of it was. I'm like, how come I can't figure this out? And I thought, I think it means no. But then I left, and I came back to the fair with my 78-year-old mother, who were walking in the cedar area, and we come to the cake, and she's looking at it, and I'm like, I think it is no. And then there's another couple who come up, and they're so cute. They had straw hats on, and they were like, around my mother's age, really younger. And they were like, oh my God, it means no. Oh, and my mother's like, yeah, I can't believe, well, isn't that what it should be? And they're like, no, we believe in yes. And she's like, oh my God, I'm going to go to war with them. And I'm like, oh my God. And I'm like, uh-huh, this is where we could have a conversation. This is very interesting. You know, my mother, who has these two gay daughters, is all of a sudden like a little kind of war with them. Look like they should be super liberal.
circle it. I'm like, oh my God, what am I going to do? Because I don't really even care. That's not what's important to me. But I kind of like got them to talk to each other for a few minutes. And then they were going to like fight a little more. And I'm like, okay, this is really good. We should say goodbye. Bye. Have a good day. They heard my mom's like kind of confused. So I decided not to get caught up. And then she's like, well, you have no right to tell them I have two lesbian daughters. And she's going to fight with me. I'm like, oh no. And then right behind me is this like beautiful transgender guy comes up and says to me, that's why I love the state fair. And I said, did you hear what happened? He said, no, that's just why I love the state fair. I went, oh, that was perfect that you came right now. I just dropped the whole thing.
Thank you. Oh, let's take a breath after that one. So I have a story. I was at work at the university hospital, and I was working with a very ill, very quiet Lutheran man. And he was so sick that when we had his care conference with the doctors and the therapists, we actually had to have it in his room instead of in the conference room. And then one afternoon I was visiting with him, and his wife was sitting there, and I said, and he was going to discharge soon, and I said, are you ready to go home now? And he said, he was really quiet for a really long time, and then he said, no. And then there was a long silence, and I said, so you're not ready to go home? And then at that moment, the gate totally, I don't know how, it just opened. So the gate beyond birth and death just opened. There was no birth. There was no death. There was no suffering. There was no problem. His wife was sitting by the bed and she felt it too. She was crying. I was crying. So it was this spontaneous movement of truth just arising. And we had the gift of being awake to it. So we have the gift from our practice of noticing when the gate's moving. And noticing which side of the gate are we playing on. And noticing if we want to move or not. And there's no prescription. There's no right, one right way, and then everything's something. Some idea I have of not suffering. So I am interested in learning to play like this. I think we can learn this. We can change from the relative to the absolute and back again. Anytime. To ventilate the game of life-giving intimacy. So we can learn to play in this way with our intention that wisdom become embodied and compassion be the scent of healing and good sense. Just common sense. So I think I'm going to read this poem to end. This is a poem by our friend Rumi, who really knew how to play with this gate. It's called Rumi, Pay Homage. If God said, Rumi, pay homage to everything that has helped you enter my arms, there would not be one experience of my life, not one thought, not one feeling, not any act I would not bow to. Anything anybody wants to discuss with each other? Is that okay? Did it make any sense? Okay, that's good. Tom?
I just have a question that I'm curious about. To do with your talk, other than you. You said you studied the Zen, then you came over and studied Vipassana, Theravada tradition. Then you went back to Zen. Why? What is it about Zen that attracts people?
I don't know what attracts people. You know, I don't know what attracts people. I think it, you know, I don't know exactly. Just that, you know, my imprinting like a little duck was on Katagiri Roshi. And so that was really deep. At that time, it was very deep, so eventually it just came back. You know, and this is the simplest answer I can think of. I think I also started to miss the poetry of Zen a little bit in Vipassana. And the Bodhisattva vow was pretty. Central resonating for me. Do you know the Bodhisattva vow? With that, so in Zen, which is in the Mahayana tradition, the vow to save all beings from suffering really resonated with me. So it's like, before I become enlightened, I will usher all beings ahead of me. That's the idea. So that resonated for me.
I asked that because before I ever came practicing Buddhism of any sort, so I read about Buddhism, it's always about Zen, and it always seems to be so inaccessible for me. My mind and wraparound seems to go up. And so they were sort of calling me, well, it doesn't mean anything. I don't understand this at all. I don't understand why, practice Zen and understand it. And I have other friends who talk that same way. That's why I'm asking.
Yeah, I don't blame them. The first time my teacher, not Dokai, someone else, gave me a koan to work with, which was about a rhinoceros. I read this koan, and then I read the commentary, and then I went to see him, and he said, well, what do you think? And I said, I don't know why they bothered to translate this into English. Why don't they just sweep all those Chinese guys out the door? Jeez. I was just like, give me a break. I have no clue. So I can relate. It grew on me, though. Is that okay?
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you think that I like your idea about the absolute and the relative, because it seems to me that that stuff lives up here, and maybe the teachings are attempting to get us out of this machine that interprets things in absolute or relative senses. So there's always this sense of absurdity that is the gate that allows you to be in your mind and be in the world even. For a nanosecond before we're back up here again with absolute and relative senses of things, which is all cogitation. So the absurdity at the end maybe is a little gate up.
Absurdity is good. I was just thinking, contact improvisation is great practice. The great
and
spiritual practice.
Or elation.
Okay.
Only
a third. What else? Yeah, please.
Can you explain more about the absolute and relative?
Yeah, so like the relative reality is like the story, you know, we're always telling, I said this and he said that and I drove my car here and good, bad, dark, light, you know, the two sides. So that's relative. Relative. And the absolute is nothing's moving. There's no side. Completely one. But actually, they're not separate. So when we talk about them, it sounds like separate, but they're completely not. They're like the leaf is falling. You know? Which side? Pretty hard to talk about. That's why we have all these goofy stories. Because it's so hard to talk about. But it's not hard to get it. You know, when we have that experience, there's not really that much to say. We just know. But try to talk about it in all those books and sutras and yeah. Is that okay? Yeah, I do. You can't think, you can't figure it out by thinking, that's for sure. Oh, hi.
Hi, you reminded me of something from many, many years ago when I first heard about Buddhism and trying to figure out what it was, and I heard about what is a bodhisattva. The answer was that somebody who avoids complete enlightenment until everyone else can come along and be enlightened too. And I was pondering that when I was on an airplane and they announced that in case of an emergency, the oxygen masks will come down. And what you're supposed to do if you're traveling with infants and children is put it on your own face first, before you try to do anything to help the children. And I said, you know, maybe it's the other way. I didn't have any kids. And that maybe you can't do anything unless you're together. And so I kind of followed the Theravada, the simple, basic. But the other has always been there. And it seems to me that just in this Vipassana practices, which is all I do, and I kind of avoid going to Zen, is only I can get to the place, and it's by sitting, and I wish I could do it all the time, is that I'm not over there, and I'm not over there in a place, and I'm not ahead in time, and I'm not behind. And I think that you're talking about that kind of centering and being here and now. But I can't get there and stay there, and maybe there are various different approaches we take depending on our moods and our inclinations. Is that what you're talking about?
I don't know.
Anyway, that's what came to
me. That's great. Thank you so much for sharing that. What else do you want to discuss?
The game was good.
Oh!
The game was good, and I think the way I discovered was that I could avoid getting touched by watching her face. If I watched her hand, I couldn't get away faster. If I saw her, if I watched her, then I knew when she was and I can't, I'm not saying that she telegraphed anything.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah.
Cool. Steve.
Well, I find this period of the election to be period potentially great suffering and standing ankle deep at least, and it seems like and I myself over my head and a warning. It seems to me that politics is so entrenched in the relative world and constantly haranguing us to stay in the relative world. And so from that point of view, it makes total sense that I experience this great suffering. When I have no perspective on it, when I actually start to become involved in it, just circling in that world. The mind, that's my family, is just circling in that world. It's just a cycle of suffering.
So we can sit down and refresh our mind.
Just to see that.
And just refresh, like take a step out of it. Yeah. See it for what it is for a minute. Yeah.
I was just thinking it just really doesn't seem real to me. I saw the video that they reacted to, and I just thought it was a disturbing, really stupid video. And I don't understand why you would react in that way. Yeah, I just think about this whole political situation. It doesn't seem real to me. I'm never going to talk to Mom, your mom in my life, Mom. I may never even see them in actual three dimensions. And I guess I don't know in reality how much of an impact this is going to have in my life when it comes right down to it. No matter whose election I'm going to have to go to work the next day. Life pretty much stayed pretty much the same in this life. So how real is it?
You're not asking me, right? That was a rhetorical question, right?
Maybe you can come up with an absurd answer. Okay, the life or something.
But,
I think there have been a couple of kinds of relatives that I find helpful in thinking about the current situation and the suffering around the election. And one is really to practice not demonizing anyone and really remembering that every individual in this is suffering, and that every individual is doing what he or she is doing for a whole constellation of causes and conditions, and that doesn't prevent working really hard, but working really hard to prevent the passage of the amendment, and really kind of being wholehearted about it. And at the same time, just remembering that everyone in here who has a stake, who has an idea, is someone suffered and is at the position that he or she is in because of just an enormous constellation of causes and conditions. And then the other part I've been doing is just trying to think 100, 300 years out and just kind of taking that, that long view and having some faith in some ways that, incrementally, human beings are in a better position than they were before, and Stephen is feeling or knowing. And so, if we take this kind of long view, and I feel really hard when the Dalai Lama was here, people, the very last question, they said, so, do you think the world is getting better? And the Dalai Lama said, I asked this very question myself to the Queen Mother because she lived a long time. And I thought, in her lifetime, she must have some idea about it. And she said, oh, yes, things are getting better. When I was a girl, people didn't have the concept of human rights. And now, even if it's not completely observed, there's that concept. Everyone has that concept. And for myself, when I was a boy, people didn't have the concept of
taking care of the earth, about the importance of ecology. And now, even if people don't do it, they don't do it, but they have the concept. I, too, think things are getting better. You know, that just really kind of heartened me. So we can take this kind of bigger perspective and just really think, you know, what we're all about is the end of suffering. And that, you know, we've committed our hearts to it. And more and more people are meditating, practicing, and taking this to heart. So even if in the short run, it doesn't seem like the goal we had was achieved, you know, we know that we've changed hearts and minds, and that, you know, it's a matter of time, and that there are setbacks, but it seems to me that taking that kind of bigger relative position for me has been really helpful, and I just don't feel I'm suffering as much as I might have without that.
So thank you, Patrice, for that beautiful Dharma talk.
Yeah.
Thank you. And I want to reiterate, because Katagiri Roshi always said, you must take the big view. And he said it just like this. You must take the big view. So I want to thank you for reminding us. That's beautiful. So is that enough? Thank you.
So we do have we have some tea and some treats out in the common room. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.